I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another Fried Egg podcast and another edition of our superintendent series, which is brought to you by Toro. Americans like our utility vehicles the way we like our U.S. Open courses, rugged. A winner needs to do it all in tough conditions, and Toro's new Workman UTX line is here to get the job done. Any job. Snow and ice removal, tree maintenance, transporting equipment or materials, whatever you need, this commercial-grade, smooth-riding, four-wheel drive monster has your back. The Workman UTX's proprietary governing system unpairs ground speed and RPM, so the operator can limit the machine's speed without gutting the power. Higher RPMs when more oomph is required, less RPMs and less fuel consumption when it isn't. That kind of all-around performance is what champions are made of. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Today's episode is with Cape Arundel's superintendent, Brendan Parkhurst. Brendan has been there for 20 plus years at Cape Arundel. This is a golf course in Kennebunkport, Maine that I, Garrett Morrison, Will Knights, and Cameron Hurtis visited in the fall. Somebody asked me recently what golf course made the most biggest impression on me in 2022, and my response was Cape Arundel. The greens are incredible. It's a really cool place, and it's a course that has done a restoration with Bruce Hepner over the years. This is not a golf course that's done like your full shutdown. This has been a piecemeal, you know, year after year improvement, and they continue to improve it. So it's a unique place, part of the country that we haven't really profiled, Maine, which has its own unique conditions, and it's right on the coast, so it has some, you know, environmental issues. And Brendan talks about all the things that go into maintaining Cape Arundel, and it's a wonderful place that everybody should check out. So without further ado, here is Brendan Parkhurst. I gotta ask, because the Korn Ferry Tour event in Maine, or I think it might not exist anymore. It was the Live Work in Maine championship, and always just a kind of funny name for everything. I know it's like the tourism kind of board saying, but how is it living and working in Maine?
I love it. I grew up about an hour and a half south, just outside of Boston. Moved here 21 years ago. It's great. We're in southern Maine, so close enough to Boston, you know, not too far to New York. We live in a town that has beach access, and then it's maybe an hour and 15 minutes to the closest ski mountain. So it's great. We love it.
Yeah. What are you doing in the winter at Cape Arundel? You know, you guys closed down, but what's the, you know, winter month maintenance schedule look like, and what type of stuff are you trying to do that during those months?
So course closes late. We really don't close until I think it's the 26th this year, 26th of November.
Wow.
And I keep myself and six guys on staff. And it's basically what we do is as soon as we shut the doors to the golfers, we start getting ready for next season. It's a relatively short winter. We like to be back out on the course by mid-March. So that gives us, you know, with time off for the holidays, that gives us, you know, roughly 10 weeks to get all the inside stuff done before we're back outside. So equipment maintenance, indoor work like that, working on course furnishings, and basically preparing for the spring.
So course furnishings like the pins, the flags, the cups, the stuff, all the benches, all sorts of stuff you see on the course.
Yeah, we make all our own tee markers, line everything up in the shop. We turn our maintenance shop into a paint shop. Same thing with the benches. Make sure all those boxes are checked, you know, so we're ready to get started. Mm-hmm. Equipment, I think we have 130 pieces with serial numbers. Everything gets through soup to nuts, oil change, spark plugs, etc. And a lot of times we'll try to refurbish one or two pieces every winter. So we keep a tech on staff, a full-time equipment technician, and he's got an assistant full-time that we keep busy all year round.
I imagine with the equipment shortages, one thing that, casual golfers that aren't really tuned into turf probably don't know is that much like the car industry, the turf equipment industry is, there's kind of a shortage, long waits to get new equipment. Has the mechanic become, like the one of the most vital employees on a turf team?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I was given the chance 20 years ago to hire an assistant or a mechanic, and the first person I hired, I chose a mechanic, and we lived that way for several years, just me and the mechanic as the top two without an assistant. So yes, certainly so. With shortages, we have to predict ahead on what we're going to need, try to increase inventory if we can. We've got pieces of equipment that we ordered last September that we're not going to see this year. So that stuff's still real. We would think, coming up on 3 years of doing this, that it would get better. But, equipment that I order now, we might not get until the end of next year. So it's that stuff's still very real and something that we have to plan for.
I was curious. This is just a question that I was wondering about while I was out there playing. The golf course, obviously, you're on a small footprint, but what meanders kind of through the property, it forks and crosses a few different holes, is the Kennebunk River. It's a tidal river. So what that means is obviously, for listeners, is that the ocean tides kind of dictate it, and the water comes right from the ocean. So when it's high tide, the water rises. When it's low tide, we were out there, it's somewhat almost like no water in the river. Does the tidal nature of that cause any, is a tidal river different than just say like a regular river or a stream or a creek that you'd see at a normal golf course? Are there any maintenance considerations that go into that?
There's definitely maintenance considerations, and those are all focused around, the tidal rise and fall twice daily. So it's a 12-foot difference between low tide and high tide, and that's pretty significant. So when it's high tide, we've got 6 hours to lose 12 feet of water, and that creates a pretty severe current. So the riverbanks that are along, a good portion of the golf course are constantly being eroded. And we took on a big erosion project maybe 10 to 12 years ago, took on another smaller one, and we're constantly monitoring the golf course for areas that are going to need to be buffeted against erosion.
How do you fight erosion?
There's a lot of permitting involved. But basically lining the riverbank where we're allowed to with large rocks to prevent us losing any more of our property to erosion.
And then what was the other aspect?
So the whole idea that tides have been increasing in height with time. And when I started, the first hole is probably the lowest point on the property, that gully there on the first fairway. That might have flooded once or twice a year on a high tide. Now that's occurring once or twice a month, and that's salt water, and it will kill grass. So we've had to deal with that just over the last 10 years, the increased frequency of flooding in that area.
Interesting. I mean, being there for 21 years outside of the tides, is there anything else that you've noticed just change in terms of whether it be weather-wise or maintenance, like things that have maybe become more challenging from just the way that the world has changed?
Yes. Just in the last 3 or 4 years, winters haven't been as cold. And, whether that's a short-term pattern or a longer-term indication of what's to come, that remains to be seen. But with those warmer winters, we're seeing insect pests specifically survive that didn't survive before. Things like the annual bluegrass weevil or nematodes. Things that a cold winter might kill off, we're having to account for those where we never did before. For a good solid 18 years, we maybe saw one or two ABWs on the golf course. Not too far south of us, they're a major problem. And now they've become a major problem for us. Nematodes, which might have been killed off in an extremely cold winter, it's not happening anymore. So we have to account for those in our spray program when we didn't have to do that before. That's increased spraying on the golf course, increased money in the budget. So that's been a big thing for us, certainly. And then there seems to be a shift from falls are warmer, and then spring stays cooler longer. April and May are probably the March, April, May are probably the worst months up here in Maine. It's brown. The trees take forever to green up. People are anxious to hit the ground running in May to play golf, and we oftentimes don't fully leaf out on trees until the end of that month. So that seems to be a little shift also.
That's probably what we'll see at Rochester next year for the PGA. Not a lot of leaves on trees. It's probably a similar climate.
You might be right.
With the tide rising, is there anything you can do to prevent? I mean, prevent the flooding, or have you guys talked about any ways to kind of fight the rising tides, or is that just is there pretty much nothing you can do?
We have, we're lucky enough that we're a good mile in from the ocean itself, so it's certainly not as severe as a coastal fronting property. Just berming up, building up the lower areas where we can. Biggest issue, like I mentioned, right now is the first hole. We built up a pretty good berm there. Maybe 8 or 9 years ago, we had to raise the height of the second tee, the second back tee there that kind of sits out on a peninsula. That used to get flooded quite a bit. I've got some great pictures that I can share with you of that tee being totally submerged. So we raised that probably 4 or 5 feet up. We were able to get the permitting to do that, demonstrate a need to do that. And that's really been helpful. So yeah, basically trying to exclude the water from the property is how we're handling that. And we've, to this point, we've been successful. Funny story about the tide. So back when we did the irrigation install, it's about 14 years ago now, we chose a contractor from the Midwest to do the work, and they showed up to get their stuff set up in the evening, set their trailers up, got a good look at the property. Next morning, I'm at work, and they show up, and I see a cart trying to chase me down on the golf course, two guys waving their hands, and they get closer, and they start screaming. They say, the dam broke. All the water's gone. You need to call somebody. The dam broke. And it took me a couple minutes to figure out what was going on, and they started pointing at the river, and it was low tide. So they had come in the night before at high tide, and when they came back in the morning, all the water was gone, and they had just assumed that there had been a catastrophe and all the water was gone. So that was something that we still chuckle about to this day.
That's really funny. it's amazing how different it is. I couldn't believe how little water is in those rivers when it's low tide. You could walk out and pick up 100 golf balls at certain points of the golf course where, balls collect if you wanted.
Yeah, it's visually so much different too. I think it's much prettier at high tide with all that water in there. And that, the high tide really only lasts for an hour, and then it's going out and coming back in. So it's very dynamic.
As I touched on earlier, you've been at Cape Arundel for 20 plus years. How would you say that your personal approach to maintenance and mindset have changed over those 20 years?
Good question. The first few years, we were very, very poor infrastructure. So we were constantly focusing on trying to regrow areas that had died over the winter. We held water until July, and then the water would evaporate, and there'd be, the mud spots would turn into dirt spots. So a huge area of focus for us was repair. As we've added infrastructure to the course, expectations have risen. So we've kind of been able to shift our efforts towards cultivation and really dialing in the product. And that's really only started to, we've really only gotten dialed in over the last 4, 5, 6 years. We didn't aerify fairways, didn't verticut. Didn't spray fairways for disease or fertility. That stuff's really only happened in the last 10 years. But with those things happening now, we've been really able to tweak the product and dial it in. Whereas, we're not chasing mud as much as we had in the past.
Interesting. It's I mean, I thought the conditions were great when we were out there. It was really in stellar shape. You know, with the golf course, I think the thing that people will obviously take away the most when they go see Cape Arundel or see photos is the wild greens. Is there a particular challenge to maintaining these greens with these massive slopes?
Yes, there definitely is. You know, I think you guys might have mentioned it in the piece that you did before, but it'd be very difficult for anybody to build greens like we have today. You know, for several different reasons. You know, my first season, we were dealing with the recent green expansions that Bruce had put into play, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and just trying to keep grass on the mounds, you know, the severe slopes. So we lost a lot of grass my first summer, trying to dry the greens out, remove thatch, and the challenge was to get grass on those humps. So that's one challenge there. And that's something that's, you know, has chased us ever since, truthfully. Really hard to keep the tops of those grass on the tops of those areas. A lot of detail work, a lot of hand work done, involved with that. This year, more than any in the past, we've kind of butted up against modern technology and the shapes of our greens, you know, maybe being the limiting factor to what we can do. We wanted to experiment with what our lowest mowing height was going to be this summer. We found it was too low, so we had to raise that height back up, and that's going to affect green speed. So we're just about maxed out at 10.5 because we can't cut those slopes any lower without the greens mowers, you know, plowing into the turf and scalping. You know, if we wanted to get faster, we'd have to consider, you know, taking out some of the contours, and that's certainly what we don't want to do. The flip side of that is, with all the contours that we have, you know, 10.5 is fast enough. Anything faster than that, and they'd be unplayable.
That's for sure. I was wondering that, and I saw you had triplexes. You mow these greens despite the severity of the contours with triplexes, correct?
We do, and that's been longstanding. Triplex reel technology. It's the same reel that we would be using with a walking mower, perhaps a lighter footprint, you know, because the weight is spread out more. But we do use the triplexes. Originally started as a labor issue, and then because the technology came along, we realized that we were doing a pretty good job. I think a couple courses have moved to triplexes on their greens. I think Medina has, and Burning Tree have moved to triplexes. This year we started double cutting every day. So years past, greens were getting cut 6 times a week. That jumped up to 14 times a week this year. And that's really been great for playability. And the greens have taken it pretty well. Just that increased traffic.
What does double cutting, achieve? Is it just smoother?
Yes, and you're removing much more grass. You know, you could cut a green 6 times and still get grass on that 6th cut. So we get, you know, a certain amount of grass with the first cut, and we might get the second cut might get, depending how fast the turf is growing, we might get, you know, 40 to 50% again with the second cut. So it's a way to get, you know, firmer, faster. It's going to firm up the surface too, help with thatch reduction. All about green speed.
You know, how have green speeds changed over the, you know, your time at Cape Arundel? Obviously, it's been, you know, over 20 years. Anecdotally, as a kid, I remember, you know, greens weren't all fast. And, you know, now it seems like every course has the ability to have relatively fast greens thanks to the technology and inputs that go into greens nowadays.
Yes, they've certainly increased. And, you know, this season they were faster than they've ever been, more consistent than they've ever been. You know, but not, they haven't increased by a huge margin. We might have been at, you know, 8 to start the season back in the early 2000s. And, you know, with dry conditions, we'd get up to 9, 9.5. So we're really not trying to move past 10.5. So they haven't increased a lot. What's changed is the consistency, the day-to-day, you know, being able to provide fast green speeds earlier in the season and then keep them consistent throughout the season. You know, it's all about getting those greens back to being firm after a rainstorm. That's, you know, being exposed to the weather 365 days a year. You know, we can't keep the rain off of it, so we need to be able to get the greens to drain out as quickly as possible. And that's, you know, that's another way that we've been able to increase green speeds over the years.
Your golf course's footprint is really small. It's only 5,800 yards, and you know, it occupies a small piece of property. What advantages does that give you as a superintendent, having such a small footprint? And are there any disadvantages?
Yeah, I think the advantages we can get around the course very quickly. Pesticide budgets are probably going to be smaller, just because there's not, you know, not as much property to take care of. Maybe the disadvantages is that everything is in play on our golf course, so that we have to maintain just about every inch of that property for golf. It's not a lot, but it all demands our attention. We focus on down the middle, and then we, you know, spread our efforts out to the edges of the property, and it's pretty much wall to wall, a high level of maintenance.
Where do you get your crew from?
Locally. You know, I'd love it if we had a, you know, migrant labor force. That's what I dealt with when I was in the Met area, right out of college. But we draw locally. The challenge there is, we have to lay off 60% of our workers for the winter. We spend a good deal of time training them in the season and then hope that they come back. But we've been successful at that, even through the labor shortages during COVID. It's a great place to work, great people to work for, and we've been able to pay a strong wage to outcompete competitors in the area. So definitely local. I think my farthest commuter right now comes for as a kid who's driving from New Hampshire every day. It's about a 55-minute commute for him, but mostly everybody else on the crew has 15 minutes to a half hour commute.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Toro. For more than a century, with cutting-edge turf equipment and irrigation solutions, Toro has had your front nine covered and your back nine too. In fact, Toro's always had your back, period. Toro is as committed to your long-term success as tour pros are committed to their shot. That's down to top-notch customer support from Toro and its dedicated local distributors, both of whom are passionate about delivering turf equipment and irrigation solutions that solve real-world problems. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor today. Now back to Brendan. So when you got hired, you jumped into a restoration effort at the golf course with Bruce Heppner. You know, what about his approach do you appreciate the most as a superintendent?
Yeah, you know, he's very protective of the original design, and he's not easily swayed by suggestions from green committees or course members, and that's not always easy to do to stand up to that. You know, fortunately, he's gotten himself into the position where he can, you know, if people don't like his attitude, he can leave. You know, he's turning away work because he has so much. But that's the most impressive thing about Bruce for me, is that he tries to really protect the original intent of the original architect.
What's been the process for restoring the course over time? How have you guys gone about planning and the, you know, execution of restoring features?
You know, for the first 8 years of my time there working with Bruce, it was one or two small projects a year. Those bunkers on nine, and those three bunkers were all we did for that first year in 2002. You know, we picked off select tees, redid bunkers where we could, you know, very piecemeal. We didn't have irrigation. We didn't have a good drainage system. So we took on the club, you know, realized that, okay, you know, Bruce's thing was, well, you have a gem here. You haven't messed it up. You know, this place can be spectacular with an investment. When I started, you know, my first memory of Cape Arundel was coming in March, and there's water everywhere. And I mentioned that earlier, that water, you know, down the middle of seventh fairway, puddles everywhere. We've got the pitch to get it off the course. It just wasn't getting there. So a big aspect of that was drainage, irrigation. We rebuilt all the tees, most of the bunkers. you know, that came about through that realization that it was time to invest a big chunk of money into the golf course. Master plan, acquiring all the permits, and then doing the work. The first big part of that was putting in permanent bridges over the two river crossings. You know, for my first 8 years, and this was one of the interview questions, do you know how to build a bridge? It was like, okay, maybe. Maybe I know how to build a bridge. But for the first 8 years, the bridges that were there were not permanent. They would come out every fall and we'd reinstall them every spring because that river freezes, the tide, the ice is still going to go up and down 12 feet. It would destroy these wooden bridges that we had. So they had to come out every year and we couldn't fully maintain the course until the bridges were back in. And reassembling them was a 2 to 3 week process in the spring. Obviously had to be coordinated with the tide. We'd have 2 hours where we could work in the river bottom, you know, carrying these uprights out. And then, you know, hoping the ice was out for the year and then spanning the length and you know, building a bridge every April, every May, in coordination with low tide. So that was the first big thing that we did was getting these bridges permanent. It gave us 3 to 4 more weeks to have the golf course open fully and to be able to work on the golf course. So that was huge. That was done a year before the bigger project of irrigation, drainage, and tees and bunker work. Looking at irrigation, when I started, everything was off street pressure. You know, the pressure that we were getting supplied from the town. There were three or four heads for every green. You'd go over and manually turn those on when you wanted to water. You know, hopefully you were well enough ahead of play. And if somebody in the neighborhood flushed a toilet, one of those heads was going to turn off. It was, you know, we were dependent on the amount of pressure that was being delivered for that time of day. The four greens across the river were watered with 3/4-inch hoses with a small lawn sprinkler. We'd drag a hose out of a box behind the green and turn on this 3/4-inch sprinkler and move it around a few times to get water. Some tees had water, most did not. Most of the fairways didn't have water. You know, and that's early 20th century technology, that we didn't have. We were 60 to 70 years behind golf courses in the area because we didn't have, you know, irrigation.
I feel like you're painting a picture of a golf course that that like a ma and pa, you might see it now, if you go visit, you know, a ma and pa golf course that is kind of in a small town where you have these, you know, kind of rudimentary and in a way, you know, is taking something from being kind of a real feel job and making it much more, obviously, I'm not saying there's no feel in it anymore, but much more regimented thing. I mean, the bridges is a crazy thing to think about, like, you know, not being able to get to part of your golf course for a large chunk of the year because you don't have a bridge.
Right. And not being able to open in the spring immediately because you didn't have a bridge and the tide wasn't going to let you put it in until next week. And that was, you know, we've got pictures of the, you know, the Bush motorcade going across these wooden bridges. It's like, oh man, I hope they hold up. They always did, you know, but pretty incredible stuff.
What's the Bush motorcade look like? What did it look like in its heyday? And I'm just with these small bridges. What was like the Bush motorcade when they were in office?
So 43 was in office when I started. You know, on the golf course, it was a lot of golf carts and, you know, layers of security, kayaks in the river, road closed. Cool thing about the Bush family is they didn't want the whole golf course closed for the time they were out there. So he would always play early, get to the 10th green, and then the golf course would open for play. So increased pressure for security on the Secret Service and the local officials because of that. But you know, we're a semi-private golf course. We have members. They weren't going to shut the place down. So yeah, when they were out there, a lot of golf carts. It was probably 12 vehicles when they entered the property. Police cars, SUVs, ambulances, and those all stuck around. And when he left, and all that left with him. So imagine, you know, a parade of 8 to 10 golf carts going across this rickety wooden bridge. That's what it was.
What, in terms of the, was there any constraints that would put on what you could do from a maintenance standpoint when they'd come out and play golf?
Yeah, we'd have to be ahead, well ahead. But, you know, if we were working on a hole, especially now, there's still a security detail that he has. But, you know, very personable with the crew, always took time to take pictures, you know, still does that to this day, very personable. You know, today we just will stand back, you know, get off the green, off to the side, wave. We were much more concerned about it when he was in office. Just starting earlier, you know, he was going to be out there at 6. We had to be out there at 5 and getting out, just staying out ahead. It was always, you know, he was done within 2.5 hours. So do our work, get out of the way, and then get back on the course once he leaves. You know, pretty easy.
One of the things I'm taking away here is that if you are the president, you lose all ability to play a spur-of-the-moment round of golf.
Well, I think you can. Certainly, it just becomes a spur-of-the-moment might be in an hour and a half, you know, and the word goes out. Advanced security team arrives, and they, you know, they do what they can. But yeah, it's definitely much more difficult. Spur of the moment, you know, probably doesn't apply.
Getting back to the restoration work that you guys have done, was there a moment in time that particularly stands out when you got maybe a green back to where it was, or and uncovered a something that was missing that you're like, wow, this is just something I didn't even know we had.
I think the most drastic change to the playing surface that comes to mind, the quickest, was with the fifth green, which is now our biggest green. It's got that, people call it a buried elephant in the front left corner there. You know, the green used to be behind that, half the size that it is. And through Bruce's work, it was expanded to double in size. And now it's got this massive hump right in the middle of it. And that's, you know, most of the bumps and humps we have are off to the sides. There's certainly severe contours within the green, but to have this massive hump in the middle of a green and to be able to expose that through restoration work was pretty neat.
Spending so much time out there, you know, I have my favorite. I'm curious, what's your favorite green surface?
I think my favorite hole is 10. Just because of the strategy that's demanded to play it. You know, 10's a cool green, a very cool green in itself with the back hump and how small it is and how it doesn't necessarily face the direction of play. 15's a sneaky green, kind of back there off the edge of the property, but you can pretty easily putt off the back of that thing when the greens are going. I really like 3 with the false front. You know, you put a pin in the middle of the green to the left, which you're not going to have a problem if you just aim a little bit, aim at the pin or just beyond it. But if you're a little bit short, man, you're way out of play on that green. That's a big false front.
Huge. Just eats balls. With the restoration, what were you guys primarily working off of in terms of materials to know what to put back? Was it an old aerial? Was it old photos? What resources did you and do you have at your disposal in terms of historical items?
We definitely had some old aerials to look at. There were some members who had been around long enough to say, hey, this, you know, there used to be a bunker here. You know, with Bruce, the amount of time that Bruce spent on the golf course early on, you know, I think he started in 95. He was picking up on things that might have been there, you know, things like that. And then, you know, Bruce's knowledge of what Travis's intent for a golf course was. We had, we've got a lot of the original greens prints. Some of those have been framed, hung up in our 43 house at our driving range. So that was helpful. But the green contours hadn't really changed much. We just had to expand those. We added some bunkers on some holes that, you know, we felt might have been there. I think it was, you know, during the Depression time or World War II, a lot of courses removed bunkers for ease of maintenance. We don't have a lot of bunkers anyway, so we really didn't add a lot back, but there were some areas that we did add bunkers to.
What was the process for restoring the greens? How did you go about restoring the green edges and getting greens pushed out?
you know, for the most part, it was just done with mow lines and gradually taking the height of cut back. You know, they had been green surfaces in the past, so they had, at one point in time, they had been low at that height. It might have been 30 or 40, 50 years since they had. But, you know, gradually mowing them down, top dressing, overseeding, till you get to the point where you're dealing with maybe, you know, smaller areas that you have to cup out and put sod in. So not bringing in a lot of sod, dealing with what was there, and then interseeding, overseeding, and top dressing, just to gradually getting those down. And that probably took 4, 5, 6 years to get that perfect. And we're still today dealing with enhanced top dressing in those areas. You know, greens have been top dressed for consistently, I'm going to say, for 40 years. The previous superintendent did a great job of that. But the areas that weren't green before didn't get top dressed as much. So we're having to apply extra top dressing around the edges to continue to build up that layer of sand on the greens.
Yeah. So instead of like stripping and smoothing out, some courses do that. Your method has been to just additionally top dress in those areas to even it out.
Yeah. It's pretty hard to sod edges of greens and get them to blend. You know, that can even be a 2 to 3 year process to get those to look, and even longer for the grass to match. You're going to get a much better color match and species match just by dealing what you have in place.
With the master plan, are you guys done? What does it look like moving forward? Are you continuing? I know you said Bruce was out working on the 17th green with drainage. Is there continuing work to be done? And if so, what's left on the plan?
So we just celebrated 125 years last year as a golf course. Most of the greens complexes are 100 years old, exposed to weather 365 days a year. So there's always going to be something. The work on 17 was an area on the back left corner that had settled 3 inches with time. It puddled up in the winter and then the grass would freeze and die. We're doing a smaller project on 10 where the left side of the green, where it's got that steep slope where it had sloughed off and moved. Gravity had taken the land down a little bit. There'll always be little things like that. The shelf life of golf features is not extraordinarily long. You know, bunkers 10 to 20 years, tees similar, irrigation system 25 to 30, similar with drainage system. So we're 14 years out from the big work, and now we're looking at, all right, what's the future look like? We just developed a 25-year capital plan, and that addresses tees, bunkers. That'll get into the irrigation. So it's been long enough that we need to start thinking about doing certain areas again.
Yeah, never works, right? It's like you just are taking care of a giant yard, you know, for everybody that can relate to taking care of one yard. You know, you're just taking care of a giant one that's always got things that are changing and need attention. When did you know that you wanted to be a work in the turf industry? What point in your life did you know this is what you wanted to do?
That's a great question. So I guess you can consider me a second generation superintendent. My uncle was a superintendent for many years on Cape Cod. My mother's brother, Tom Flaherty. I knew from pretty much, I think, age 12 that it's what I wanted to do. You know, getting to be outside, working on a beautiful piece of property. So it's different every day, and you can make a pretty good living doing it. So I knew very early on that I wanted to do that. I worked on my first golf course, graduated high school, and then moved down to Cape Cod with Tom when I was 18, the year before I went to Penn State. Then I tried to work as many golf courses as I could. Until I settled at Cape Arundel. So I knew really early on that's what I wanted to do.
That's, what was the biggest shock, I guess? You know, you knew you wanted to do this. When you started doing it full time, if you could think back to that, what was the biggest adjustment?
So I can remember I lived with Tommy for the summer after I graduated high school, and we drove to work every day, and we, you know, talk about what we're going to do that day and, you know, long-term stuff. And one thing that he said that stuck with me, he said, the toughest part of this job is the politics. And I was like, "What?" You know, 18-year-old kid. I was like, "What are you talking about? I'm not running for elected office. I want to grow grass." You know, so that was kind of the biggest surprise once you step into that, just the daily politics of you know, being out there every day and running the golf course, not just with members or golfers, but even individual demands of your staff members. You know, most important thing that I do is manage, you know, people and get my staff to see the golf course the way I see it.
What's been the best way for getting that message across, whether it be to staff members seeing the way you see the golf course, but also probably members seeing that?
Yeah, you know, it takes a little bit of time to prove it out. It's not immediate. You know, with the staff, you kind of have to show them that, you know, this is the right way to do it. Definitely giving them a voice. You know, I don't have all the answers. I don't see everything. Keeping an open door to suggestions, suggested improvements, different ways to do things. Patience, you know, not immediately jumping to conclusions, taking the time to get to know people and what their motivations are. You know, some people motivated by money, some people are motivated by praise, some people want time off. Trying to figure that stuff out and being able to relate to all my staff members as best I can.
The politics internally with the club and members, is there anything with the membership that has been a big thing that you've overcome over the years? Is it being there for 20 years, is there something that was a constant theme early on that's kind of died off, and how did that happen?
For my 21 years, I've worked for a great group of people. They love the golf course. Everybody cares about it. Majority of the work that we did was supported by private donations. So, you know, not too many challenges on that front. There was times in the past where, you know, we knew we had to raise some money. Dues went up, assessments were levied, you know, years ago, and we lost quite a few members. Some of those people ended up coming back because they realized that, you know, we were making the right decision in improving the golf course. So another issue we had is those four holes across the river. Those were on a 100-year lease, and we didn't own those until the early 2000s. When we purchased those, they were owned by a woman who was an abutter. She passed away. Her four children inherited the property, and three of them agreed to sell to the course, and one of them did not want to. And that was a challenge. That resulted in the house that was built behind the 15th green that you might have noticed. So, you know, the positive is that we now own those holes and no longer had to really lease them. So that was good.
Yeah, that had to be, that would have been a tough pill to swallow if they wouldn't sell the land.
Yeah. And it was, you know, at that point we had some history with the property. We were, you know, historically taking care of it forever. Bruce was actually called in to testify about the, you know, does this really make sense to keep this as a golf course, or can you change it and still have a house? And it ended up in our favor that the only change we had to make was maybe shortening that 15th hole by 10 yards instead of having a house built where the 17th cross bunker is, you know? And that was an interesting few years, definitely.
So that green, it got moved?
It just kind of got flopped a little bit. It was about 5 to 10 yards deeper. You know, there's the fence along it now, and there's a driveway back there. That was all trees before, no house. So grew it in the back and shaved it out in the front. Not major. It was, you know, very fortunate that's all we had to do.
All right. Brendan, it was a great pleasure having you on. I was very impressed. I think I got asked the other day by somebody, like, what was the most, what was the course that stuck with you most in 2022? And, it was definitely your place. Those greens are incredible, and I can't wait to come back out there. And, thank you for coming on, you know, giving us, insights into your life and experiences at Cape Arundel. It's a really cool place that everybody should try and get out to see.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for coming out to see our place. We really enjoyed having you guys.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast and our Superintendent Series. This episode was edited by Meg Atkins. Meg, thank you. As a quick reminder, we've got, obviously, Black Friday. It's getting into holiday season. It's scary to say that. We're past Halloween. The Fried Egg Pro Shop is stocked up. We've got a ton of new gear in there, ton of fall and winter gear. Check it out at proshop.thefriedegg.com and get your favorite piece or something. Treat yourself, treat a friend that you know loves the Fried Egg, whatever it may be. We will have a big holiday sale also that will be coming around Black Friday. So check out the Pro Shop, eye down what you like. We will have a sale around Black Friday. So thank you again for listening. We will be back with another episode this week. And, you know, we'll finish the year strong on this podcast. We've got some good stuff in the hopper. So thanks for supporting us. And we look forward to finishing out 2022 on a high note.